Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is your shortcut to being genuinely well-informed, and today we're tackling, well, a really profound and detailed topic. The complex legal landscape, the statistics, and the stringent investigative protocols around child abuse and neglect response. We're going deep into the foundational professional training material. This is the curriculum, really, that sets the absolute rules for everyone involved, you know, from mandated reporters right through to investigators.
And our mission today is clarity. This material, it's dense, it's full of statutory language, very precise definitions, time-sensitive mandates.
Right.
And when we talk about child protection, it's unlike almost any other area. Precision is just. It's the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to try and distill these complex rules, these physical indicators, the legal penalties, into clear knowledge for you.
Okay.
Showing you not just what the rules are, but maybe why they're structured this way. And, you know, highlighting how detail and sticking to the process are just non-negotiable for safety and justice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's unpack this straight away. Because before we dive into all the legal nuances, we really need to grasp the sheer scope of the problem. We have to ground this discussion in the stats, the national and state statistics, to really set the stage for why these laws are so necessary.
Yeah, the national picture is sobering. The scale of child maltreatment, it's truly massive. Annually, we're looking at more than 600,000 children abused in the U.S.
Wow.
And according to the most recent data we reviewed, specific 2023 figures, there were an estimated 546,159 unique victims. Confirmed abuse and neglect.
Just pausing on that number for a second. Over 500,000 confirmed unique victims in 1 year. That figure alone, it just demands extreme vigilance, doesn't it? From professionals and really from all citizens who interact with kids.
It really does.
And the tragic result is also quantifiable.
It is. In that same period, 1,820 children died from child abuse and neglect.
Oh, God.
And it's also crucial to understand how the system gets these numbers. The source material points out that over half of all reports, 51.3% to be exact, were started by professionals.
Right.
So that really underscores how the system relies fundamentally on mandated reporters doing their job.
Yeah.
That whole network of protection, it starts with trained eyes observing and then acting.
Right. And when investigators trace these tragic events back, they pretty quickly identify the perpetrators. And the data here, it's also very specific and maybe challenges some assumptions people might have. Who are we talking about usually?
Well, the overwhelming majority of perpetrators are people the child knows intimately, really intimately. About 80% of identified perpetrators were parents.
80%?
80%. And when we drill down into the gender breakdown, looking at the 2023 data, women actually made up the larger percentage of perpetrators at 52%.
Interesting.
Yeah. And this is critical because it tells us that intervention strategies, they have to focus on that primary caregiver unit. That's often where children are most vulnerable.
Okay. So if we break down the type of maltreatment reported, we see one category just dominating the landscape nationally.
Absolutely. The dominant form by far is neglect.
Neglect.
Nationally, neglect accounts for more than 64.1% of victims. That's nearly three-fourths of all confirmed cases.
Three-fourths.
And this statistic, it's often startling to people because when they think child abuse, they typically picture, you know, physical injury.
Right. Bruises, broken bones.
Exactly. But the day-to-day failure to provide for a child's basic needs, that's the most statistically common form of harm reported.
So neglect is the biggest slice by a long shot. How do physical and sexual abuse compare them?
Well, physical abuse currently sits at about 11% of confirmed cases. That actually represents a slight decrease in the data we looked at.
Okay.
Sexual abuse accounted for 10%, which conversely showed a slight increase. And sex trafficking, while statistically lower, it accounted for 0.2% of victims. But, you know, that number is notoriously hard to capture accurately. It's definitely an area of intense focus right now.
Okay. Let's narrow the focus specifically to state data now. Looking at Texas as detailed in the sources, the sheer volume of incoming calls compared to the confirmed cases, it really shows that rigorous screening process you mentioned earlier.
Yes, absolutely. The Texas stats we reviewed show 262,420 total referrals.
Wow.
That's the initial flood, the suspicion reported to DFPS, the Department of Family and Protective Services. Of that huge number, 157,519 actually led to completed investigations.
Okay, so quite a drop already.
A big drop. And then that funnel narrows significantly again, resulting in 68,517 confirmed cases of child abuse or neglect.
That is a huge gap. I mean, nearly 200,000 referrals were screened out or didn't meet the legal threshold from investigation. And then what? Over half of the investigated cases didn't meet the standard for confirmation? What does that tell us about, you know, the initial reporting versus the need for really high legal standards?
It tells us two really fundamental things, I think. First, the public and professionals are reporting in large volumes, which, you know, is good. The message is getting out. Second, the legal threshold for confirmation, which we'll get into in detail next, it's intentionally very high. DFPS is mandated to follow up, but they have to establish that the legal definitions of harm were met before they can confirm a finding or intervene formally.
I see.
So that massive gap you mentioned, it speaks directly to the resources needed just to sift through reports and, frankly, the inherent difficulty in proving abuse or neglect in a legal sense.
Okay. And regarding child fatalities in Texas, the numbers are specific and heartbreaking. They detail not just the confirmed cases, but also the ongoing vigilance needed.
Yeah, the sources detail 826 investigated child fatalities overall. Of those, 251 were confirmed where abuse or neglect was the root cause.
Okay.
And looking at the more immediate 2024 data, 99 deaths were related to confirmed abuse and neglect.
Mm-hmm.
But what really stands out to me in the sources is the specific detail about substance use in these death cases.
That's the unexpected statistic we need to explore, right?
Exactly. It's a crucial detail and maybe a bit counterintuitive. In the 2024 child death cases where a perpetrator used drugs, marijuana was the most commonly used substance. It was noted in 48 cases.
Marijuana, more than others.
More than others listed in that specific context. Now, this detail doesn't suggest marijuana caused the abuse directly.
Right. Correlation, not causation.
Precisely. But it highlights that substance use, even substances sometimes perceived as less dangerous, is a significant contributing factor, or at least a marker, in the environment where fatal abuse or neglect happens. It forces investigators to look beyond just, you know, traditional hard drug use when they're assessing household risks.
Okay, so to move from the statistics to the actual enforcement, we absolutely have to master the legal definitions. The entire structure of the child protection system, it really hinges on correctly applying the Texas Family Code, specifically Chapter 261.001.
Yes. We have to start with the basics, the building blocks. DFPS, of course, is the Department of Family and Protective Services. The sources also specifically define exploitation, and they make a clear distinction between that and general abuse.
Okay, how does the code draw that line for exploitation? What makes it different?
Exploitation is very specific. It's the illegal or improper use of a child or the child's resources for monetary or personal benefit, profit, or gain.
Okay.
But critically, it applies when the perpetrator is an employee, a volunteer, or someone working under the umbrella of a facility or program. So this definition, it's primarily aimed at addressing abuse or misuse within, say, institutional or organizational settings.
Got it. Now let's dig into what makes a case a DFPS case versus maybe just a standard law enforcement case. This distinction, it seems to center entirely on the definition of the person responsible for a child's care, custody, or welfare. Let's call them the legally responsible party, or the PR, just to make it easier for listeners. Who falls into this crucial, pretty expansive category?
Yeah, this is absolutely core. It determines jurisdiction. And the definition is intentionally broad because the law recognizes that caregiving responsibility goes way beyond just biological parents.
Right.
So the PR includes, obviously, parents, guardians, foster parents, but it specifically extends to any family or household member, and significantly, a person with whom the child's parent cohabits.
Ah, okay. That inclusion of cohabiting partners, the boyfriend, the girlfriend, that seems vital. Because it immediately brings a really common source of non-parental abuse under DFPS's specific investigative mandate.
Precisely. If that cohabiting partner is the alleged perpetrator, DFPS has the mandate to investigate straight away.
Okay.
And furthermore, the definition includes school personnel or volunteers, and any personnel or volunteer at a public or private childcare facility or a private residential institution.
So pretty much anyone in a position of trust or care.
Exactly. Now, if the alleged abuse is committed by someone not defined as a PR, let's say, a stranger, or a neighbor who isn't part of the household, then law enforcement handles the investigation initially, unless DFPS decides the circumstances need their involvement too.
Okay.
And this mechanism, it prevents DFPS resources from being spread too thin on cases that are purely criminal and not linked to a sort of systemic failure of care or custody by someone responsible for the child.
Right. It keeps their focus tight. Let's move to the legal definition of abuse itself. How does the law define mental or emotional injury? As you mentioned, this requires more than just subjective distress.
It really does. It requires objective evidence. The injury must result in an observable and material impairment in the child's growth, development, or psychological functioning.
Observable and material.
Yes. So this means investigators can't just rely on someone saying the child is upset. They have to demonstrate that the alleged actions resulted in a measurable negative change, a functional impairment in the child's life, something affecting their ability to function in the family, at school, in the community. It also covers causing or permitting a situation that leads to that demonstrable impairment.
That standard sounds quite high. It seems designed to filter out, you know, general disciplinary friction or teenage angst and focus on genuine, provable harm.
Exactly. Now, compare that to physical injury. This is defined as any injury resulting in substantial harm or even the genuine threat of substantial harm. And here's a key phrase that triggers investigation. Injury that is at variance with the history or explanation given.
Wait, at variance with the history, that phrase essentially tells investigators to look for lies, for cover-ups, for inconsistencies, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And it's a critical legal tool. If a child has, say, a broken arm and the parent says, oh, he fell off the bed, but the injury itself, maybe it's a spiral fracture, is biologically and clinically inconsistent with a short fall,
right?
Then the injury is at variance with the history. That discrepancy alone gives DFPS grounds to move forward, even if there isn't a direct witness. And importantly, the code explicitly excludes accidents or reasonable parental discipline, as long as it doesn't expose the child to a substantial risk of harm.
Okay. And what about failure to prevent? What does the code mean by that?
This is a major area of culpability. It captures that passive yet incredibly damaging role of a co-responsible adult. It's defined as the failure to make a reasonable effort to prevent another person, often that cohabiting partner we mentioned, from causing physical injury that results in substantial harm to the child.
So standing by and doing nothing isn't an excuse?
Not under Texas law, no. The legal principle here is that omission, failing to act when you know or should reasonably foresee danger, can be just as culpable as committing the act itself. The sources mentioned the tragic Sabrina Ho case as a key example of this principle, establishing that a passive parent who fails to step in can be held legally accountable.
Okay, let's cover the other key abuse categories quickly. Sexual conduct seems clearly defined.
Yes, it's comprehensive. It covers any sexual conduct harmful to a child's welfare, including all the relevant penal code offenses. It also explicitly includes compelling or encouraging a child to engage in sexual conduct, involving them in pornographic performances or sexual trafficking. And just like with physical abuse, failing to make a reasonable effort to prevent harmful sexual conduct is also considered abuse.
Got it. And substance abuse is an explicit part of the abuse definition, too.
It is. Abuse includes a current use of a controlled substance by the PR that results in physical, mental, or emotional injury to the child.
Okay, tying back to those fatality stats.
Exactly. And it also covers causing, permitting, or encouraging the child themselves to use controlled substances. Lastly, we have to note the specific inclusion of coercing marriage, forcing or coercing a child into a marriage, is legally defined as abuse in this context.
Okay, now let's pivot to neglect. We established earlier this is the most dominant form of maltreatment nationally. How does the family code categorize this, well, complex failure to provide care?
Neglect is broken down into several distinct types of failure. The first is abandonment, leaving a child in a situation involving substantial risk without arranging necessary care and demonstrating an intent not to return.
Pretty clear cut.
Seems so, but proving intent can be tricky. The second category is unsafe situations. This involves placing or failing to remove a child from a situation that requires judgment beyond their maturity level and which results in bodily injury or a substantial risk of immediate harm. This is often the category for severe environmental hazards like, you know, unsafe housing conditions or exposure to dangerous situations.
Okay. The third category is a critical one related to health, medical failure.
Yes. Medical failure is defined as failing to seek, obtain, or follow through with necessary medical care. And the key here is it has to result in a substantial risk of death, disfigurement, or an observable material impairment to the child's growth or function.
So it's not just about not going to the doctor.
Right. It's also about not following the treatment plan. Taking the child to the doctor once isn't enough if the PR then ignores the prescribed treatment needed to mitigate a serious risk.
Okay. And finally, the failure to provide basic needs, food, clothing, or shelter. This is where the law makes a really important distinction regarding financial hardship.
This distinction is crucial, really, for policy reasons.
Yeah.
Failure to provide basic needs necessary to sustain life or health is neglect. However, the code explicitly excludes failure caused primarily by financial inability. Unless relief services, things like aid programs, food banks, housing support were offered to the family, and they knowingly refused them.
Okay, so the system targets willful negligence, not just poverty.
Exactly. Unless the family actively rejects available help that could fix the problem. The system is designed to step in for deliberate failure, not just economic hardship.
That's an important nuance. And finally, we should just note the specific definition of facility negligence.
Right. Facility negligence focuses specifically on those institutional settings we talked about earlier. It's a negligent act or omission by a facility employee or volunteer, including failing to follow an individualized treatment or care plan that causes or potentially causes substantial emotional harm, physical injury, or death to a child served by that program. It basically holds organizations to a higher standard based on their professional role.
Okay, so moving from the legal code to the actual investigative process on the ground, we need to talk about the visible evidence now, the physical and behavioral signs that suggest an injury might be at variance with the history. Let's start with physical indicators, specifically pattern bruising. Where are investigators taught to look for those really definitive signs of trauma?
Well, the training really emphasizes looking beyond the simple accidental bruises you see all the time on kids, you know, shins, foreheads.
Right.
They're trained to look at specific locations and, crucially, patterns that mimic the object used. For instance, on the upper arms and hands, investigators look for very specific hand marks. Oval grab marks left by fingertips, linear marks from the edge of fingers, sometimes clear hand imprints, and crescent-shaped pinch marks.
Okay.
And circumferential bruises, bruises that wrap all the way around an arm or leg, are highly suspicious. They usually indicate forceful grabbing or holding during an assault, not just a bump or fall.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What about marks from instruments, particularly on the torso?
The buttocks and lower back are critical areas to examine. Investigators look for strap and lash marks. These are often linear or rectangular bruises, maybe 1 to 2 inches wide.
Like from a belt.
Exactly, or a switch. And the classic, highly diagnostic pattern is the loop mark bruise. This is caused by something doubled over, like an electrical cord or a belt folded in half.
Oh, I see.
The ends of the loop hit the skin at the same time, leaving this distinct, often parallel mark that is virtually pathognomonic, basically. A definite sign of inflicted trauma. Very hard to explain away accidentally.
Okay. And injuries to the face and mouth, they can be quite subtle, but still telling, right?
They can be very subtle, yes. We look for slap marks on the cheeks, on the earlobes, or injuries from someone pulling hard on the ears. Crucially, specific injuries to the upper lip, or the tongue's frenulum, that little piece of tissue under the tongue, or connecting the lip, those can indicate violent slapping, forced feeding, or maybe having a hand shoved over the mouth to silence the child. The sources also train investigators to recognize what they call bizarre marks. Things like pattern contusions that match an object, actual tattoos used as marking or punishment, circumferential ligature marks that suggest bondage, choke marks on the neck, and abrasions at the corners of the mouth, which are often signs of gagging.
This sounds fairly straightforward, but this is exactly where an investigator needs real cultural awareness. We have to talk about pseudo-bruises marks that can be easily mistaken for inflicted trauma. And the risk of a false accusation here is massive.
Oh, absolutely. This is a point of extreme sensitivity in the training materials, and rightly so. The most common pitfall, globally, really, is misidentifying Mongolian spots.
Right, the birthmarks.
Exactly. They're benign birthmarks, technically congenital dermal melanocytosis, extremely common in certain populations. About 90% of African Americans, 80% of Asians have them. They often appear on the buttocks and lower back, precisely where inflicted bruises are also common. Misinterpreting these as abuse has led to just disastrous investigative errors in the past.
And recognizing folk medicine practices is equally critical, isn't it?
Absolute vital. Practices like cupping, where heated cups create a vacuum and leave a circular suction bruise.
You see those sometimes on athletes.
Yes, exactly. Or coining spoon rubbing, also known as gua sha, where a coin or spoon is rubbed vigorously on the skin, causing a friction bruise. Both of these can be easily misinterpreted by untrained medical staff or investigators. That friction bruise from coining, for example, could look like a burn or a strap mark to the unfamiliar eye.
So how do they tell the difference?
Well, the training emphasizes recognizing the specific presentation. Cupping leaves circular, usually evenly spaced bruises. Coining leaves linear, often symmetrical marks, typically along the back. And crucially, understanding the family's cultural context and asking the right questions is key to avoid jumping to the wrong conclusion.
Okay. Let's move to inflicted bone injuries or skeletal trauma. You mentioned extremity fractures are most common, but what specific types of fractures are considered highly suspicious no matter where they are?
The focus is really on injuries that require immense force or an unusual type of force that's inconsistent with a child's normal activity level. So highly suspicious fractures include chip fractures and bucket handle fractures. These are tiny bits of bone pulled off the main shaft. Also, epiphyseal separation, where the growth plate is forcefully separated. Both of those require very high sudden force.
Okay.
And then the classic signs of twisting or ringing injuries are spiral fractures of the long bones. The bone breaks in a kind of corkscrew pattern, which definitively rules out a simple fall.
And where are these twisting or ringing injuries often seen? The sources gave some interesting context on that.
They did. Well, they can happen anywhere. These types of injuries are heavily scrutinized, especially in daycare or other custodial settings. Some data suggests they affect girls slightly more than boys and often involve the left hand.
The left hand, why?
Well, the theory is if the caretaker is right-handed, they're using their dominant hand to apply that rotational force to the child's left arm or hand.
Ah, interesting detail.
Yeah. And they're most commonly seen in kids aged about 6 months to 2 years old. That's an age where children are too young to accurately report what happened, but they're mobile and actively interacting with caregivers. So the history given for the injury becomes absolutely paramount for proving it wasn't accidental, because kids that age do have accidental falls too.
Right. Beyond the limbs, what other bone injuries are huge red flags for abuse?
Fractures of bones that are naturally protected by soft tissue or the body's structure. So ribs, they account for about 19% of inflicted skeletal trauma, the sternum, the scapula, shoulder blade, and vertebral fractures in the spine. Those are all highly suspicious. Also, finding multiple fractures at different stages of healing is often definitive evidence of repeated trauma over time.
Okay. Let's turn to inflicted burns. These account for about 10% of abuse cases, you said. What specific characteristics distinguish an abusive burn from an accidental one?
The most common abusive burns are scalding burns from hot liquids, and they're often characterized by a visible immersion line, a sharp, clear demarcation line showing where the body part was forcibly held in the hot liquid.
Like a water line.
Exactly, like a water line. You also often see specific areas of sparing. These are mirror image spots or donut-shaped areas where the child's skin was maybe pressed tightly against the bottom of the tub or where folds of skin were protected from the hot water. Accidental splash burns are actually pretty rare in confirmed abuse cases. Abuse tends to involve that forced full immersion.
And specific contact burns, what do those look like?
These are burns from forced, sustained contact with a heating device like a hot stove, a floor heating grate. Or sometimes you see specific recognizable branding burns from heated metal objects like a curling iron or even a cigarette lighter, which leave a clear, defined pattern of the instrument right on the skin.
Okay. Now, the most lethal form of a head injury.
Yes. Child abuse head injury, now more commonly called abusive head trauma, or AHT, formerly known as shaken baby syndrome. Tragically, it's the most common cause of death in child abuse cases.
And the mechanism here is deceptive, right? Because there's often no visible external injury.
Exactly. That's what makes it so insidious. The injury results from violent shaking, which generates these intense deceleration forces inside the skull.
Okay.
These forces cause the brain to rotate and shear within the skull.
Okay.
This tears tiny blood vessels and nerves, leading to intracranial hemorrhages, bleeding inside the head. Retinal hemorrhages, bleeding in the eyes,
yeah.
And diffuse brain injury. But because the head itself might not hit a hard surface, there's often no bruise, no cut, no outer sign of trauma. It's a silent but potentially lethal trauma. The damage is internal, caused by that rotation and shearing.
The sources also include a preventative strategy here, which seems essential given how serious the outcomes are.
Yes. The training materials actively promote the period of purple crying to educate caregivers and hopefully prevent this tragedy. It's basically a behavioral explanation designed to normalize intense, inconsolable crying in infants, aiming to reduce caregiver frustration.
PERECLE. That's an acronym.
It is. It reminds caregivers that this intense crying phase is peak of crying. It increases weakly, peaks, then subsides. Unexpected, starts and stops without reason. Resists soothing. Nothing seems to help. Pain-like face. They look like they're in pain even when they're not. Long-lasting can go on for hours and often happens in the evening.
Okay.
By helping parents recognize this as a normal, temporary developmental phase, the hope is they're less likely to get frustrated enough to shake the infant.
Right, framing it as normal, not malicious.
Yeah.
Finally, let's discuss the behavioral and circumstantial red flags for abuse or neglect. This is where the story provided by the caretaker gets cross-examined against the actual clinical evidence.
Yeah, the primary red flag here is the inconsistent history and behavior. Investigators are trained to look for explanations that just don't align with the type or severity of the injury. Those classic stories like falling downstairs or falling off a bed when the child has, say, multiple fractures or internal injuries.
Right.
And crucially, investigators are specifically trained to document any variations and inconsistencies in the explanations given over time, maybe told to different people. There's actually a key investigative tip mentioned in the source material. Let them tell their lie. Act like you believe them.
That seems counterintuitive maybe to someone untrained. Why emphasize that strategy? Why not confront them?
It's a fundamental tenet of good investigation, really. The initial goal isn't confrontation, it's gathering information and documentation. By maintaining composure, acting calm, and letting the suspect volunteer their story without immediate challenge, the investigator documents that initial, often fabricated account. Later on, those inconsistencies become powerful evidence that the explanation is at variance with the history. If you challenge them aggressively right away, they might just shut down, lawyer up, or refuse to cooperate further. It's often a long game focused on building the case and securing evidence of deception.
Okay, makes sense. What are the red flags related to the actual treatment provided or the child's presentation?
Treatment failures are massive red flags. Things like inadequately treated injuries, significant delays in seeking medical treatment for a serious injury, or as we mentioned before, finding injuries at different stages of healing, which suggests repeated chronic trauma.
Okay.
The child's behavior itself might be extreme, showing unusual hyperactivity, maybe extreme anger or intense fear. Or conversely, they might be severely withdrawn or almost desperately starved for attention. For neglect specifically, investigators look for things like inadequate appearance, dirty, inappropriate clothing, signs of malnutrition, or failure to provide basic needs like necessary dental care, required immunizations, or safe shelter.
And specific parental or guardian behavior during the process can also be a flag.
Definitely. Investigators watch for doctor shopping, parents who take the child to multiple different hospitals or ERs, maybe trying to find a doctor who won't ask the hard questions. They also look for unusual parental behavior during interviews or exams. Being strangely under-concerned about a serious injury, or maybe overly concerned in an inappropriate way.
Yeah.
Or being uncooperative, refusing necessary diagnostic tests like x-rays. And the sources also specifically list the risk factor of boyfriends or step-parents, as they often fall under that PR definition we discussed. And statistically, they are unfortunately implicated in a significant number of severe non-accidental trauma cases. Okay, so once those indicators start pointing towards abuse or neglect, the mandatory reporting structure kicks in. This is all governed by the Texas Family Code, Chapter 261. And the law is extremely strict about who has to report and when.
And the legal requirement is immediate, right? Okay. For everyone.
It is. The law says any person, literally anyone who has reasonable cause to believe a child's physical or mental health or welfare has been adversely affected by abuse or neglect, shall immediately make a report.
Yeah.
It's framed as a civic duty for everybody.
Okay. But for professionals, the mandated reporters, the timeline is even stricter, and the obligation, it sounds like it's personal and non-transferable.
That's exactly right. Professionals, this includes anyone licensed or certified by the state or employed by a state licensed facility who has direct contact with children.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking doctors, nurses, teachers, daycare workers, law enforcement officers. They shall report no later than the 48th hour after they first suspect abuse or neglect.
48 hours? That's tight.
It is. And here's the critical non-negotiable part. They may not delegate this duty. You can't ask your supervisor to make the call for you or rely on someone else down the hall reporting it. If you, the professional, suspect it, you are legally obligated to report it yourself. The failure of your colleague or your boss to report doesn't get you off the hook.
Wow. Okay. And this brings us to a really foundational legal point. The law basically obliterates traditional professional confidentiality in these situations. That seems like a pretty dramatic decision the legislature made, prioritizing child safety above all else.
It is a dramatic decision, and yes, that's precisely the rationale. The reporting duty applies without exception to privileged communications. This means it overrides the confidentiality rules that normally apply to attorneys, clergy members, medical practitioners, psychologists, social workers, everyone.
So no privilege stands in the way.
None. In the specific case of suspected child abuse or neglect, the duty to report to protect the child overrides every single professional privilege that might otherwise exist.
Okay. There's also a requirement, it seems, to report even when the victim is now an adult, but the abuse happened when they were a child.
Yes, there's a specific mandate for that, designed to protect current potential victims. A professional shall report if they have cause to believe an adult they're working with was a victim of abuse or neglect as a child. And they determine in good faith that disclosing this information now is necessary to protect the health and safety of another child currently, or perhaps an elderly or disabled person.
So it connects past abuse to present-day protection needs.
Exactly. It creates a bridge to protect others who might be vulnerable now.
So where do these reports actually need to be made? Who do you call?
The report needs to be made to one of three places. Your local or state law enforcement agency, DFPS, usually via the statewide hotline, or the state agency that operates, licenses, certifies, or registers the facility where the alleged abuse occurred, if it happened in a facility setting.
Okay. And what needs to be in the report?
The report has to reflect the reporter's belief that abuse or neglect has occurred or may occur, or that it has resulted in a child's death. It needs to identify the child, the person suspected of being responsible, if known, and all the pertinent facts that led to the suspicion.
And the system provides pretty robust protection for the person making the report, assuming they act in good faith.
It does. Anyone who acts in good faith when reporting, or assists in the investigation, or testifies later on, is granted immunity from civil or criminal liability. This good faith immunity is absolutely fundamental. It encourages reporting by minimizing the personal risk involved in getting involved.
Right. People need to feel safe reporting.
Exactly. And furthermore, the reporter's identity is kept confidential. It can't be released unless the reporter waives confidentiality in writing, or if it's disclosed specifically to law enforcement as part of a formal criminal investigation.
Okay. But if the system is misused, if someone makes a false report maliciously, the penalties are severe. Let's talk about the false report penalty. This really underscores the gravity of making that call.
Yes, the law tries to maintain a careful balance here. Knowingly making a false report with the specific intent to deceive is a state jail felony in Texas.
That's serious.
It is. And if the person has a prior conviction for making a false report, it gets enhanced to a third-degree felony. On top of potential jail time, the person convicted of making a false report must pay any reasonable attorney's fees the falsely accused person incurred defending themselves, plus a $1,000 civil penalty payable to the state.
Wow, so significant financial and criminal consequences.
It's meant to be a strong deterrent against malicious or truly reckless reporting.
Okay. Conversely, what's the penalty for failure to report when you are legally required to?
For any person, including professionals, the failure to report when required is generally a Class A misdemeanor. That's still serious, carries potential jail time and fines. But the penalty gets immediately elevated to a state jail felony under specific aggravated circumstances. If the child involved was disabled or resided in a state-supported living center and suffered serious bodily injury as a result of the unreported abuse, or, critically, if a professional failed to report specifically with the intent to conceal the abuse or neglect. The law is significantly tougher on professionals who deliberately try to cover things up.
Right, betraying that professional trust. And there's one more specific penalty related to failing to report sexual assault.
Yes, that falls under the Texas Penal Code, Section 38.171. It states that if someone observes the commission, or attempted commission, of continuous sexual assault of a child, or aggravated sexual assault of a child, and they fail to immediately report it to law enforcement or CPS, the failure itself is a Class A misdemeanor. There is an exception written in. If reporting immediately would place the observer themselves in danger of serious bodily injury or death. But otherwise, witnessing those specific severe felonies triggers an immediate mandatory duty to report. All right, so once a report is received and accepted for investigation, the system shifts into high gear, following strict agency protocols laid out in Family Code 261.301. Now, we mentioned earlier that DFPS is only required to investigate if a legally responsible party, the PR we defined, is the suspected perpetrator. If not, local law enforcement usually takes the lead, at least initially.
Okay. And the prioritization of the response seems critical, given how time-sensitive preventing further harm can be.
Absolutely critical. Yeah. The system is tiered based on the assessed level of risk. DFPS rules require an immediate response, meaning as soon as possible if the information suggests the child's death or substantial bodily harm could result without immediate intervention. Reports classified as the highest priority, priority one, require a response, usually an attempt at face-to-face contact, within 24 hours. Second highest priority reports, priority 2, require a response within 72 hours. These rigid timeframes basically dictate resource allocation across the entire agency, making sure the most life-threatening situations get attention first.
Right. What happens when the allegations are really severe and clearly criminal in nature?
That situation mandates a joint response. Any investigation that involves an alleged criminal offense posing an immediate risk of physical or sexual abuse and where death or serious harm is a potential outcome shall be conducted jointly by local law enforcement and DFPS.
So they work together from the start.
Yes. And the Code of Criminal Procedure actually requires law enforcement to respond within 24 hours of being notified by DFPS about these specific joint investigation cases. This ensures that both the civil track, focused on child protection, and the criminal track, focused on investigation and potential prosecution, begin simultaneously and share information.
Okay. There's also a specific requirement mentioned about coordinating with the military if service members are involved.
That's right. DFPS investigators have a duty to determine if a suspect in an abuse or neglect case is an active duty member of the U.S. Armed Forces or the spouse of one. If they are, DFPS must notify the U.S. Department of Defense Family Advocacy Program at the closest active duty military installation.
Why is that?
It ensures that the military's own support and protective systems are aware of the allegations. The military has its own procedures and resources like counseling or potentially issuing military protective orders that can be brought to bear to help protect the child and family members involved.
I see. Let's discuss the actual conduct of investigation under Family Code 261.302. What kind of access are investigators legally guaranteed?
The law grants them pretty broad access to investigate the report. The scope includes a visit to the child's home, unless the case can somehow be ruled out without needing a home visit. It also includes interviews and examinations of the child who's the subject of the report or any other child in that home. These examinations might include medical or psychological evaluations if needed.
And where can these interviews happen? Can they talk to the child at school?
Yes. Interviews can occur at any reasonable time or place, specifically including the child's school or childcare facility. Investigators can also transport the child for the interview if necessary, although DFPS policy generally requires them to attempt to notify the parent before transporting the child, unless doing so would compromise the child's safety.
Okay. Regarding the child interviews themselves, the requirements around recording them seem highly specific. It sounds like they're designed to protect the integrity of the child's statement.
They are absolutely designed for that. DFPS interviews with children about the specific allegations of abuse or neglect shall be audio or video recorded. The exceptions allowed are very narrow. Things like equipment malfunction, but only if it's not due to poor maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the child is genuinely unwilling to be recorded even after reasonable efforts by the interviewer, or truly unforeseen circumstances that prevent the equipment from being present.
Why the strong mandate for recording?
It's crucial because having that recording prevents future questions or disputes about exactly what the child said, how they said it, the context of the questions asked, and the interviewer's demeanor. It provides objective evidence for later review, whether in court or during case planning.
Okay. And what about non-DFPS agencies like local police departments? Do they have to record interviews too?
Yes, generally. Interviews about physical or sexual abuse conducted by non-DFPS agencies like law enforement shall also be taped unless the agency determines there's good cause not to. Examples of good cause might be related to the child's very young age, or maybe the nature of the allegations doesn't lend itself to formal recording.
But there's a consequence if they don't record without good cause.
Yes, and it's a significant one. The Family Code explicitly states that the fact that an agency failed to tape an interview is admissible evidence at the trial of the offense. This means the defense attorney can bring up the lack of a recording to the judge or jury, suggesting maybe the interview wasn't conducted properly or the child's statement wasn't accurately captured. It puts real pressure on agencies to record whenever feasible.
Okay. We need to revisit the source material's advice on the initial suspect interview. The instruction was, be cool and don't let the circumstance dictate your emotions. What's the rationale behind telling investigators to basically play it cool, even when dealing with potentially horrific allegations?
It's a classic and often necessary long-term investigative tactic. The instruction is essentially to maintain professional composure, focus on gathering a basic timeline of events, clarifying the suspect's initial account, but pointedly avoid aggressive interrogation techniques early on.
Why?
Because the investigator is playing the long game. They want the suspect to remain cooperative, maybe even believe this is just a routine inquiry. They often avoid mentioning specific agencies like Child Protective Services by name initially, or acting like they already know all the details. The goal is to obtain enough initial information, perhaps including inconsistencies documented calmly. This can then be used to secure a fuller, more detailed, and often formally recorded interview later, once more evidence is gathered. If you go in too aggressively at the start, the suspect is much more likely to shut down, demand a lawyer, or even flee.
So it's about information gathering, not immediate confrontation.
Exactly. Document the initial story, build rapport if possible, and save the tougher questions for later when you have more leverage.
This emphasis on careful initial interviewing seems linked to the broader goal of avoiding re-victimization of the child.
Precisely. A huge goal of the modern approach is to minimize the number of times a child victim or witness has to recount the traumatic events, especially to different people who may not be trained in forensic interviewing. Best practice is for initial information to be gathered from any adult witnesses who heard the child's first disclosure, the outcry. Then, the child should be referred immediately to a specialized child advocacy center or other trained specialists.
Right.
These specialists can conduct one comprehensive, forensically sound, and recorded interview in a child-friendly setting, designed to get the necessary information while minimizing further trauma.
This brings up the rule that allows hearsay or outcry statements in criminal proceedings. It's detailed in the Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 38.072. How does that work?
This law is absolutely essential for prosecuting many child abuse cases where the child might be too young or too traumatized to testify effectively in court. It allows certain hearsay statements, specifically statements describing the alleged offense made by victims younger than 14, to be admissible in court.
Under what conditions?
The key condition is that the statement must have been made to the first person, aged 18 or older, to whom the child told about the offense. This person is often called the outcry witness. The statement is admissible in prosecutions for specific sexual and assaultive offenses against children, provided the judge determines after a hearing that the statement is reliable based on the time it was made, the content of the statement, and the circumstances surrounding it. It basically acknowledges that a child's immediate, spontaneous report to a trusted adult is often very powerful and reliable evidence.
Okay, let's talk about emergency possession, taking a child into protective custody without a court order first. That's covered in Family Code 262.104. This sounds like a really high-stakes decision for the person involved.
It absolutely is. And the law provides protection for the person making that incredibly difficult call. Anyone, including a private citizen, though usually it's law enforcement or DFPS, taking possession of a child without a court order, is immune from civil liability if they have reasonable cause to believe there's immediate danger to that child's physical health or safety. And taking possession is necessary to protect them.
And what are the specific legal grounds that justify a law enforcement officer or DFPS worker taking a child into emergency possession without an order?
The grounds are explicitly laid out. They can do it based on their own personal knowledge of the facts or based on information provided by someone else that gets corroborated, if that information would lead a prudent person to conclude there is immediate danger to the child's physical health or safety,
yeah,
and there's no time to get a court order. Specific situations mentioned include believing the child is a victim of sexual abuse or trafficking, believing the legally responsible party is currently using a controlled substance in a way that constitutes an immediate danger to the child, tying back again to those substance abuse issues. Or, if the PR allowed the child to remain on premises where methamphetamines were being manufactured or used.
And where can these children not be held once they're taken into emergency possession?
The law is very clear on this. A child taken into emergency possession cannot, under any circumstances, be held in isolation, placed in a jail cell, or detained in a juvenile detention facility or any other secure detention facility meant for delinquent youth. They must be immediately released to DFPS, a designated emergency shelter, or another authorized placement agency. Now, the structure that facilitates many of these complex steps, especially the interviews and coordination, is the Child Advocacy Center, or CAC. They really are the hub of the multidisciplinary team approach.
Right. What makes that CAC system work, and what's the role of the Interagency Memorandum of Understanding, the MOU?
CSTRs are required by law to operate using this multidisciplinary team, MDT model. This necessitates a formal, written MOU that links DFPS, local law enforcement agencies in their service area, and the local prosecuting attorney's offices.
What's the purpose of that formal agreement?
The main purpose of this mandatory MOU is to minimize the re-victimization of child victims, by coordinating the investigation efforts. It ensures cooperative team methods for sharing facts and developing the case together. So instead of a child potentially being interviewed separately by a police officer, then a CPS worker, then an assistant DA.
Right, telling the story over and over.
Exactly. The goal is to have one forensically sound interview conducted at the scene by a trained specialist, which is observed by the team members and recorded, serving the needs of all the involved agencies. The MOU outlines how this collaboration will work, and it must be re-executed at least every 3 years to ensure it stays current.
And the confidentiality of the records held by the CC is also strict.
Very strict. The law states that records, reports, and working papers developed by the CAC in providing services are explicitly confidential and not subject to public release under open records laws. Furthermore, while the CAC facilitates and conducts the electronic interview recording, the recording itself legally becomes the property of the prosecuting attorney if the case moves toward criminal charges, or DFPS if it remains a civil matter or isn't prosecuted. However, DFPS must always be granted access to those recordings for their own case management and safety planning.
Okay. Finally, let's quickly review the medical consent laws. These are vital, especially when a child is in emergency protective custody and might need treatment. If the legal consenter, usually the parent, isn't available, who can consent to immediate medical treatment?
If the legal consenter can't be contacted after reasonable effort, the Family Code, Section 32.001, allows several other adults to consent for the child. This includes a grandparent, an adult sibling, an adult aunt or uncle, school personnel who have written authorization for the parent, or a court if it has jurisdiction.
And crucially, for emergency situations.
Crucially, a peace officer who has lawfully taken custody of the child and has reasonable grounds to believe the child is in need of immediate medical treatment may consent for that necessary treatment. However, the law specifically states this power does not extend to consenting for immunizations.
Okay. And under what specific conditions can a minor child actually consent to their own medical treatment?
There are several conditions listed in FC 32.003 where a minor can consent themselves. If they are on active duty with the U.S. military, or if they're 16 years or older, living separately from their parents, with or without parental consent, and are managing their own financial affairs.
Okay.
They can also consent for diagnosis and treatment of an infectious, contagious, or communicable disease that must be reported to the state, like STDs.
Mm-hmm.
They can consent for treatment related to drug or alcohol abuse or addiction.
And
they can consent for examination and treatment related to pregnancy, except specifically for abortion, which still requires parental consent or a judicial bypass.
Got it. And the power of a physician to examine a child without parental consent seems critical in suspected abuse cases.
Yes. Family Code 32.005 is a key protective measure. It allows a physician, dentist, or psychologist who has reasonable grounds to believe that a child's physical or mental condition has been adversely affected by abuse or neglect to examine that child, if they are 16 or younger, without needing parental consent.
Yeah.
This can happen even if the parents object, unless there's a specific court order prohibiting it.
And what can that examination include?
It can include procedures necessary to diagnose the condition, like x-rays, blood tests, and taking photographs of the child's body, as long as it's relevant to evaluating the suspected abuse or neglect. This allows medical professionals to gather crucial evidence needed to substantiate a case, even when parents are uncooperative or trying to hide injuries. You know, if we connect all this back to the bigger picture, the sheer depth and complexity of these definitions and mandates, it's really something. From needing that observable and material impairment for emotional injury to the mandatory joint investigations for potential felonies to knowing the difference between a loop mark bruise and a cultural practice like coining, it just underscores the immense gravity of these roles, both for professionals and for citizens who report.
Yeah.
The system demands incredible precision. Recognizing that even a small misstep, misinterpreting an indicator, failing to follow a protocol can have devastating consequences, either leaving a child in danger or potentially leading to a false accusation that could destroy a family, it's a heavy responsibility.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Well, this knowledge, it really moves beyond just, you know, being aware. It becomes operational knowledge. Understanding those strict legal thresholds for abuse versus neglect, knowing exactly who counts as a legally responsible party, internalizing those immediate timelines for mandatory reporting.
Mm-hmm.
All of this really highlights that informed vigilance is basically the only way this complex, often resource-strained protection process can actually work.
Mm.
And that applies whether you're a mandated professional reporter or simply a concerned neighbor or family member.
And, you know, the statutes we reviewed, they clearly detail severe penalties. penalties for failing to report when you should have, but also penalties for knowingly making a false report with intent to deceive. This legal structure, it creates a genuine ethical tightrope for anyone involved in reporting.
On one hand, the system grants immunity for good faith reporting, strongly encouraging vigilance. On the other, it threatens a state jail felony for intentional deception. This inherent tension, the risk of serious penalty for error or malice on either side of the reporting decision, it forces professionals, ideally, to operate purely on reasonable cause and good faith, relying strictly on the facts and indicators they observe, regardless of the potential personal or professional stakes involved. That critical balance point, that tension, that's definitely something for you to mull over.